Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. On today's show, we'll be talking with baker extraordinaire Dori Greenspan and the author and journalist Alex Prudhomme. The two share a Julia Child connection. Dori worked with Julia in the 1990s and wrote one of her cookbooks, and Alex is Julia's grand nephew. We didn't schedule them to be here at the same time on purpose. It's a matter of scheduling serendipity, but we're glad it happened this way. This season of Radio Cherry Bomb is brought to you by Knopf, publisher of food's most fabulous icons, including, of course, Julia Child, Lydia Bastianich, and Knopf is also home to new literary talents such as Sweet Bitter's Stephanie Danler. Our first guest is Dori Greenspan, one of the most loved human beings I know.
Oh.
She's authored a number of great baking books, worked with Julia, as we mentioned, and macaroon king Pierre Hermé, and she splits her time between Connecticut and Paris, which makes us terribly jealous. Her newest book, Dori's Cookies, was just released this week. Dori Greenspan, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
I am happy to be here again. Thank you.
Oh, we're so excited. We're so excited. So this new book.
This new book. This is my new baby. It's my 12th. Do I look like a woman who has 12 children? Sometimes I feel like that. But this is the book. You know, it's so funny. I always knew I would write a cookie book. And when I would tell friends, I'm writing a cookie book. They would say, a bookie. They would say, well, of course you are. But I just never knew when. And now is when.
So why is now when?
You know, I had created so many cookie recipes, and I love cookies. I grew up in a, no one in my house cooked or baked, but we ate cookies from a box, you know, store-bought. Everybody in my family loved cookies. I created a family of cookie lovers. The picture of my son at his, our son, sorry, Michael, at his first birthday party shows him eating a homemade cookie. I've always loved them, and I had created about 300 cookie recipes. And I still had more I wanted to do. And so this was the moment for cookies. This was a chance for me to kind of stretch what I thought of as cookies and what I could do with cookies.
So Dori's Cookies is a fantastic book, but stylistically, it's a departure for you. Where your previous books were maybe more traditional and look and feel, this is definitely modern. Why the aesthetic switch?
Cookies just called out for this. So the new book, I love the new book. I love the look of the new book. So the photographs were done by Davide Luciano and the food styling by his wife, Claudia Fica. And I had met them about 4 or 5 years ago and loved them and their work. And when I started to work on cookies, I knew from cookie one that I wanted them to do this work. And so the book is so colorful. So it has so much purple in it, which is my favorite color, and pink and blue and red and yellow. And the pictures, the cookies are, you know, cookies as big as your head. And it's just, I love the graphic look of it and kind of boldness. And to me, it's a happy book. It's like the perfect, the look is the perfect match for cookies.
Claudia is wonderful. She's the food stylist for the Cherry Bomb cookbook.
Of course, she worked on the issue that I was in.
That's right. She's been in our magazine from day one. So when we got to work with her on our cookbook recently, it was really a joy. She's fantastic.
We Davide and Claudia and Cindy Gaspar, who worked with them, came to our house in Connecticut, and we worked for 18 days together. And
Was it a giant Dori sleepover?
Well, they stayed in an Airbnb, but it was a giant, oh, it's time for lunch and let's all cook lunch together. And, oh, it's time to have drinks after work to celebrate the work that we did. It was so much fun.
That sounds a lot more civilized than most cookbook shoots.
This was the best.
So, Dori, one of the things that struck me, so you've got this book, it's a lot more modern in feel. You had mentioned to me all the different social media things you're doing tied in with the promotion of the book. You did a Facebook Live session. You did a Twitter Q&A. You are not afraid to go with the times?
I am loving the times. I started my blog in 2007, I think, because I was so, I guess not being brought up with the internet, seeing it appear and realizing how I could be in touch with people I cared about was so exciting for me, and I haven't lost my enthusiasm for it. The connection, which sounds funny because that's what it's all about, but it's just a wonderful way for me to be in touch with people I love and people who love what I love.
It's opened you up to a whole new world of bakers, I would imagine.
Absolutely.
And
Absolutely. You
love a home baker. I know that. You call yourself a home baker.
Well, I'm hoping we're going to talk about Julia later. But Julia, when I was working with her, one day just put her arm around me and she said, "You know why we make such a good pair?" And I said, "Tell me, Julia." And she said, "Because we're just a couple of home bakers."
That's so sweet.
Yeah.
And speaking of sweet, as part of the book, you're doing a campaign called, it's a hashtag campaign, Cookies and Kindness.
Yes.
And I've seen that hashtag pop up a lot since you started it. Obviously, the world needs more kindness and it always needs more cookies. But what's behind that?
Well, that's exactly what was behind it. The news is just enough. I feel like the world is wobbly at this moment. And I bake cookies all the time. I bake just about every day.
I just had an image of Jell-O. The world is like a big bowl of sad Jell-O right now.
The world is like a big bowl of sad Jell-O. And I thought, it's so easy to make people happy, a single act of kindness. And as bakers, we never really bake for ourselves. We bake to share. And all of a sudden, I thought, hashtag cookies and kindness. Let's do what we always do, which is bake and share. And let's show people that we're doing this. And so I had this idea that people would go around like little cookie elves and drop off bags of cookies for the fire department, or meet the school bus with cookies, or surprise a neighbor by putting cookies in the mailbox or at the doorstep. I just had this like crazy, wouldn't the world be better with these random acts of cookie kindness? So hashtag cookies and kindness. And I have been so touched by what people have done and the cookies that they've made. It's been great.
What is the last random act of cookie kindness that you participated in?
Well, I hadn't meant to do this. I made a batch of cookies and I gave them to a friend who just dropped by. And that evening, there was an emergency, and somebody had to be taken by ambulance to the hospital. So I took the rest of, in the middle of all of this going on with the ambulance and the sirens and whatever, I packed up the last of the cookies, tied them with a bow, and gave them to the medic crew that came on the ambulance, and they actually came back to thank me. They said it was so sweet, and they ate them during the night and loved them. They got coffee malted cookies.
Oh, that's really sweet. Is that recipe in your
cookbook? Yes, it's in Tori's cookies.
So if anyone out there does a random act of cookie kindness, make sure you do use the hashtag cookies and kindness and tag Dori so she knows what you're up to.
Please, yeah. If you tag me, then I'll see it and I'll chat with you about it.
So you mentioned earlier that you grew up in a family that loved cookies, but no one baked or cooked.
No, my mother finally, when we left the house, just used the oven as a bread box. Yeah, it's true.
So how do you become such a great baker?
Necessity. I always say I was born and then I got married. I've been married forever. I was a college student when I got married. And I had never cooked. I mean, who would have taught me to cook? And I found that I loved it. It was like playing house. I loved cooking. I loved having people around the table visiting us and having dinner with us. And I discovered how excited people got when you baked something for them. And so I started baking.
A lot of trial and error?
A lot of trial and error. But, in baking, I think more so than in cooking, the errors taste good. Even the errors taste good. It's hard to go wrong with butter, flour, sugar, eggs.
Speaking of which, I wanted to ask you about the trend we're seeing right now away from white flour, white sugar, butter. You've got this whole new crop of bakers. Many of them are vegans. They're creating things that are dairy-free, egg-free, gluten-free, etc. And they're working with all of these alternative flours, natural sugars, ingredients like agar-agar. Mm. Have you been experimenting with any of that?
I've played with a few of the ingredients. I don't know them well enough to make fabulous stuff out of them, but I follow other people's instructions. So, you know, Genevieve Coe just wrote a new book called Better Baking. Alice Medrish has flavor flours, and I've baked from those books, and they're great.
People like Erin McKenna, who's...
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
You're a big hero of hers. That's the basis of her whole company.
So sweet. But I bake... I bake with fairly traditional ingredients, although in the new book, there's togarashi, there's ground-up Triscuits.
Wait, what's togarashi?
Togarashi is Japanese pepper, crushed pepper. And I made... I'll come back to alternative, but just have to tell you about this cookie because it was so exciting. When I was working on Dory's Cookies, which was like 3 years worth of cookies, when you're thinking about nothing but cookies, you start dreaming about them. And I had these what if experiences. What if a meringue didn't have sugar? Would it still be a meringue? Would it hold? Oh, I will bake that what if. And so I made a non-sweet meringue. And then I thought, it worked, but it's totally boring. What if it were hot and spicy? And so I made a togarashi, that peppery meringue. I had so much fun working on this book. But so I've been using some alternate flours, and I use them mostly for flavor and for texture. So I love buckwheat. And I've been using buckwheat. I've been using more whole wheat flour than I used to. But for me, particularly with cookies, I know a lot of people are doing this for health reasons. And if you have to, I'm so glad that you can make something delicious. But I'm always looking for the taste, the texture, the pleasure that a cookie gives me. I'm the first taste tester. And so I try to make every cookie sufficient unto itself so that if all, heaven forbid, all you could get was one cookie, it would really give you everything that you wanted. And so I will be playing more with other ingredients, but always to that same end, to make something that will just make you so happy.
That's great. You know, you brought up the meringues. Have you tried that aquafaba?
I haven't, but
yet,
it's
so
almost
intrigued.
Miraculous, right?
It's just, I find the whole thing so interesting, not just the aquafaba, but there's so much disruption in every part of our lives today, whether it's technology, politics, you name it. And to think that today you've got people baking and not using eggs, butter, white sugar, white flour, it's really just so fascinating.
Well, it's so fascinating and it's so exciting because for people who can't have some ingredients, to be able to have something that's wonderful is... That's terrific. But I love, it's kind of a luxury to be able to play with food like this. And we're very lucky to have it. And to have, I mean, aquafaba, that's the goop from chickpeas. I mean, there's probably another, well, there's another
word for it.
That's
a good way to put it,
right?
Though. Chickpea water, some people call it.
Oh, that's nicer. But who would have thought to make a meringue out of it? It's not, I mean, this is really because we have the luxury to play in. That's pretty fabulous.
It's exciting to think that maybe in another decade or so, we'll have a whole new crop of cookie classics that maybe have nothing to do with the ones that we sort of grew up knowing and loving.
Well, I hope so, because I love the evolution of food. And actually, when I was working on Dory's Cookies, knowing that I had already had, you know, 300 cookie recipes or so behind me, my idea wasn't to do a best of or greatest hits or anything. I just wanted to, like, to add to all my basic ingredients, add curiosity, see what I could do that would kind of stretch me. Because the reason that I write cookbooks is so selfish, to learn more, but also because I can then teach more, but also to see if I could change what a cookie is. And so I did a bunch of cocktail cookies.
What's a cocktail cookie?
A savory cookie to have with cocktails, sparkling wine. I did a cookie with Old Bay Spice, pretzels, and cheese to have with beer.
Did you give it a name?
I think I called it the Old Bay Pretzel and Beer Cookie.
And wait, you said you used ground up Triscuits as an ingredient too, right?
So when I was younger, a fancy little pass around hors d'oeuvre was a Triscuit with cream cheese and major grade chutney on it. And I don't know why I thought about that. And I thought, can that be cookieized? What can I do? I mean, when you're thinking about cookies, this happens in your brain. And so I had this idea about rugola. So rugola made from a cream cheese dough. I thought, what if I ground up Triscuits and put it in the cream cheese dough, and instead of making a sweet filling, I filled it with spicy major grade chutney. It's pretty good.
Yum. Yeah. That sounds great. I think you invented a new word there, cookieized.
Oh, well, it's probably the first time I've said it out loud because it's not easy to pronounce. But that was the word that kind of played in my head because I also cookieized pumpkin pie, well, sweet potato pie, complete with the marshmallows on top, pecan chocolate pie. So like all the Thanksgiving pies I've now made into bar cookies. So great for a crowd.
Okay, everyone obviously needs to get Dory's cookies pronto. So I have a tough question for you, not to put you on the spot, but...
But you're going to
but
anyway.
But I'm going to anyway. You've seen so many trends come and go. You've worked with so many industry greats. Julia, as we'll talk about in a little bit. Pierre Hermé, the macaroon king of Paris. And you've really become someone we all love and admire.
Thank you.
As you look back, what is a piece of advice you can share with all of us or just something that guided you along the way that you can share?
You know, I was the kid who wouldn't raise her hand in class because I was too shy. But as I started to work in food, and it was really hard because when I got started, I wanted to be in the kitchen and nobody wanted a woman in the kitchen. And I was turned away and, I mean, the whole story that we've heard from other women. And I wasn't really, you know, a put myself out front person. But because I wanted to work in food so much, I said yes to everything. Everything scared me, but I said yes anyway. And that's, I don't know where I got the courage to do that, but I'm glad I did. I've had some pretty terrible jobs. I've had some pretty wonderful jobs. But just say yes. Just go out there. Put yourself out there. Stretch yourself. Say yes.
I love it. Mm-hmm. On that note, we're going to take a break for a word from our sponsor, Knopf. But Dory, as I mentioned, will be back in a little bit to talk about her time with Julia Child. Imagine the culinary world without the influence of Julia Child, Marcella Hazan, Edna Lewis, Maher Joffrey, Lydia Bastianich, and Judith Jones. It's impossible. We have the iconic publishing house Knopf to thank for bringing the writings and the recipes of these women to life. Knopf's great tradition of supporting new voices continues today with Smitten Kitchen's Deb Perlman, Sweet Bitter's Stephanie Dandler, and Butter Baked Good's Rosie Dakin. Check out Knopf's great collection of fiction, nonfiction, and cookbooks at your favorite bookstore. Keep reading and keep cooking with Knopf. Our next guest is the author and journalist Alex Prudhomme. He's the grandnephew of Julia and her husband, Paul Child, and co-wrote Julia's memoir, My Life in France. He's also written about such light subjects as terrorism, the environment, and biotechnology. His latest book is The French Chef in America, a look at Julia's second act and a sequel of sorts to her memoir. Alex, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
We're thrilled that you're here. Congratulations on the new book.
It was a really fun book to write, I have to say, but it wasn't a book that I set out to write. It was a book that kind of found me. As some of your listeners may know, I wrote Julia's memoir, My Life in France, back in, which was published in 2006. And after that book came out, Nora Ephron optioned it for half the movie Julie and Julia, and that was very exciting, and I did several book tours. And then I went on to do other things, writing, as you mentioned, about the environment and energy and so on, and kind of left Julia aside for a bit. But there were questions that had lodged into my brain. Julia died in 2004, so she wasn't around to answer them for me. So a decade after the memoir came out, I circled back to Julia and began to poke around. And I discovered a kind of a hidden history of a whole second career, what I call the second act, that Julia had once she and Paul had retired from the diplomatic service and settled in Cambridge, Mass. And she re-Americanized herself very intentionally. She got away from strictly doing classical French cuisine, performing as the French chef.
I noticed you said that in when I was reading the new book, you said performed as the French chef, and I thought that was a very interesting verb to use.
Right. Well, the French chef was a persona, and she had to reinvent that persona and to become Julia Child. And this was part and parcel with her breaking up with her French colleague, Simca Beck, with whom she had written Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Volume 1 and Volume 2, and finding her own independence and her own voice, which she did in the 70s. So this new book, The French Chef in America, is really about Julia in the 60s and 70s when she's a celebrity on television. She reinvents herself as Julia Child, and she finds this voice that she had kind of honed on air but was reluctant to put on the page. But it was with much urging by her editor, Judith Jones, at Knopf, who really pushed her to write in the first person and tell personal stories for the first time. And what's funny about this is that, you know, Julia was a natural ham and performer and very charismatic. But in person, she was quite modest and didn't like to talk about herself. So writing in the first person for her was semi-traumatic. But she realized that, you know, number one, she needed to kind of distance herself from her past as the French chef and doing working with Simca and so on. And number two, to translate that much-loved and often satirized voice that she had on television to the page, which she did. And the book that resulted was called From Julia Child's Kitchen, which came out in 1975. And I'll just add one more thing, which is she was 63 years old when she did that book, at a time when many people are contemplating retirement. And here she was, reinventing herself, finding new energy, and going off on this amazing trajectory where she actually reached the height of her celebrity.
How old was she when you worked on the memoir together?
She was 91
wow.
plus. The memoir, My Life in France, was something that her husband Paul, had first thought of in 1969. And it never appeared, and Julia often referred to it over the years as the France book. And I kept saying, well, how's the France book, Julia? And she said, oh, it's coming along, dearie. And it never appeared. And I grew up, and I graduated from college, and I had my own career as a writer, and I offered to help her in various ways. And she would always say, not right now, dearie. She would never say no. But finally, in December of 2003, I went to visit her in Santa Barbara, where she had retired. And I said, how's the France book, Julia? She said, well, it's not so good now. I said, well, I'm here to help. And so she said, okay, let's do it. So we sat down and began to work together.
How long was that process?
It was about 8 months. Her birthday was August 15th. And so once or twice a month, I would fly from New York to Santa Barbara, and I would sit with her for a few days, and we would go over the material for the book. And I would write it up, and she would correct it or add to it. The difficulty was, as I said, Julia was modest and didn't like to talk about herself, which I belatedly realize is why the memoir never appeared. And it was difficult for me to extract stories from her. I would say, now, Julia, tell me about your little apartment in Paris. And she would deflect, and she would say, oh, well, it's a lovely little place, but how are your children? And I'd have to say, well, no, this isn't about me. This is your memoir. And it took a long time, and I finally found the key to unlock Julia, which was this wonderful series of letters that Paul and Julia wrote to my grandparents from Paris and Marseille to Pennsylvania. Now, what you need to know is that Paul and my grandfather were twin brothers. Julia and my grandmother were very good friends, and they would write back and forth every week. And the family kept the letters, and they're in pristine condition. They're now at the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe. They're wonderful, full of detail. And my technique was to read aloud from the letters, particularly Paul's. He was a wonderful writer, full of descriptive detail. And in hearing those words, it brought Julia back to the moment, and it allowed her to talk about them and, by the way, herself, but kind of indirectly. And then once the story started to flow, they began to bubble up from her subconscious. And she was 91, and so, you know, she had moments of great sharpness and then, you know, moments of less sharpness. And I had to always carry a pad with me because we'd be driving along and we'd see a field of strawberries, and this is California, and she'd say, oh, that reminds me of the wonderful strawberries we used to get in the Paris markets. And she'd be off on a story. But, you know, half an hour later, she wouldn't remember. And so I had my quote-unquote notebook as a bunch of crinkled up pieces of paper with scribbles on them because I'd be writing on my knee as I was driving or wherever.
Tell me about doing the second book, because you didn't have Julia there.
Right. So the second book, as I said, I circled back to Julia a decade after the first, and I had these questions about what happened once they returned to America. What was their life like in Cambridge? How did she get on television and become successful so quickly? I mean, she first got on TV as the French Chef in 1963, and by 1966, she had won an Emmy and a Peabody. By 1967, she was on the cover of Time magazine. I mean, that's remarkable. I don't think you could do that today, really. And she had this huge cultural impact. And since she wasn't there to ask, I went into the archives and began to research the letters. I went to WGBH, which was her home PBS station in Boston, and they had some wonderful old footage that they allowed me to see. And there were two things that struck me. First of all, there was a pattern I noticed that Julia would reach an obstacle either in her personal or her professional life, and it would stymie her for a moment, and then she'd figure out a way around it, and she would reinvent herself and move off in another direction, and often to greater effect than ever. And I saw this happen time and time again. It was amazing. And the second thing was I noticed that she had done this intentional self-reinvention, which I don't think anybody else has really noticed, and I only noticed it because I was looking closely at that era. And it's really remarkable. I found a series of letters where you can see her trying to work out who she's going to be on the page. And in the course of the research, I discovered all sorts of anecdotes about Julia and Paul's lives that either I had forgotten about or never knew about. There was a lot of stuff that was kind of out of the public eye. So my initial idea was to write an article about this, but I quickly discovered I had far too much material, and I sat down to write a book, and the result is The French Chef in America, which I think it's a quite inspiring story. I mean, it's almost more inspiring than My Life in France, which is a wonderful kind of first-person narrative by Julia. But this book is in the third person. It's in my voice, so I was able to report around her, talk to her editor and her producer and her friends in Cambridge and so on. And what strikes me is that, and what makes it timely is that, you know, she rejiggered her career while in her 60s, during the 70s when the world was in turmoil. And you look around today, and a lot of people are, by choice or by circumstance, having to reinvent themselves in midlife.
I think we call it pivoting now, right?
I think that's the word.
Julia Child pivoted.
She did. As usual, she was ahead of the curve.
So let's talk about you for a minute.
Mm.
So you write about such varied topics. You're one of those writers who really can master anything.
Well, thank you. I don't know if I'd say I'd master them, but I'm a very, like Julia, I'm an inquisitive person, and I don't like doing just one thing. In the publishing business, people like to put you in a box and say, okay, this is your beat. And I've had to fight hard to not be put in a box and to do a lot of different things. There is a kind of method to my madness, but that would take too long to explain. But there are things and people that intrigue me that I pursue, and they're all kind of related in a weird way. But I've written on everything from, you know, monster trucks to biotech to fracking.
Terrorism. A lot of scary things.
Yeah, the design of Julia's kitchen. and so I do have a bit of a flypaper mind. But I like working this way because it keeps me interested.
Are you an optimist despite these heavy topics you tackle?
Yes, I'm a cautious optimist. I think I wrote a book about fresh water and why I think it's going to be the defining resource of this century. And that's called The Ripple Effect. And the notion behind that book is that every time we use water, intentionally or not, we set off a ripple effect, a series of consequences that we're often not aware of. And that as the population grows, as the climate changes, I think water is going to be the defining resource for all of us.
We could probably talk about this for an entire show, but
yeah,
I was very disappointed. Exactly. Yeah. I was disappointed that none of the debates, the environment was brought up.
I know. Climate change was, as you know, persona non grata during the debates, which I thought was outrageous and, you know, a denial of reality. I think it would have actually been an interesting subject to hear what the candidates had to say.
Absolutely. All right. On that note, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with, we're going to bring Dory back into the room, talk about Julia a little bit more since Alex and Dory haven't spent a lot of time together, but Dory's mentioned in your new book.
That's right.
And then we'll do our speed round. We'll be right back. In the studio with Dory Greenspan and Alex Prudhomme to talk about Julia Child. So you two have met before, right?
Yes.
Just last year, I think, for the first time.
Yeah. We met in Santa Barbara.
That's right. It's a Julia Child Festival.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And Dory, when exactly did you work for Julia again?
So I spent the summer of 95 in Cambridge when we were shooting Baking with Julia. Do I have 2 seconds to tell you about meeting Julia?
Absolutely.
So my first book was called Sweet Times, and it came out in 1991. And I don't know how, but I ended up on the same program at BU with Julia and Jacques Pepin. And I was going to do a demo. I did a demo. I had to. And Julia was her most wonderful self, her usual self. She came up to me afterwards. I was the last one. So, like, after everybody had been so fabulous, little me, you know, went up and did this. She put her arm around me. She hugged me. She said, "You're wonderful. Let's have dinner together." And there was a big dinner for everyone who'd been involved. And we're sitting across from one another at a table for four. And she said to me, "Have you ever seen the Dan Aykroyd imitation of me?" On Saturday Night Live, I said, "Julia, I am probably the only person in America who hasn't." She said, "Oh, I'll show you how it went." And Julia stood up and did the entire chicken, bloody hand, whole thing imitation. So it was kind of meta, a word we didn't use then. It was Julia imitating Dan Aykroyd, imitating Julia. It was so great.
You know what's amazing about that? That skit aired in 1978. And we're still talking about it. It defined Dan Aykroyd. It defined SNL. And to this day, it defines Julia Child. I can't tell you how many people who of a younger generation who came to Julia through Dan, and they say, "Well, I have Julia's voice in the back of my mind." I think to myself, "No, you have Dan Aykroyd's version of Julia in the back of your mind."
As
Save
I said,
the
meta.
Yeah.
Did she have a good sense of humor?
She had a great sense of humor. She didn't like mean-spirited humor. There were certain comedians who were kind of mean, and she didn't like that, and she would just kind of ignore them. But she actually loved the Aykroyd impersonation, as Dory just said. Mm-hmm.
Alex, when were you aware that you had this famous aunt?
Well, it was a two-phase process. When I was a little kid, Julia and Paul would come from Cambridge down and stay with us in New York City, and we had a little black-and-white TV. We'd watch Julia perform, and then she would appear in my parents' apartment. And I thought, oh, she just stepped out of the TV. But I later realized, as I grew up, that and every time we would go out to dinner, you know, people would come up to her, and I realized, oh, so she's a famous person. She, you know, and that television is this kind of magical realm. And it was a process of maturation, I guess.
Yeah. Do you two ever worry that the world is forgetting about Julia?
I think I'm often surprised by who has been forgotten. But I have never said Julia and had to say, oh, Julia Child. Julia's still...
I think if you go to the to Julia's kitchen at the Smithsonian, you'll see that she is magnetic. Even though she's been dead for 12 years, people go to that kitchen and they get stuck there. People of all ages and races and creeds, they just, you know, that kitchen was Julia's original kitchen from Cambridge. It was meant to be a temporary exhibit at the Smithsonian, and it's still there, and it's now the entryway to a whole new American food hall, and it's really remarkable. And you see people go in there just thinking they're going to glide through, and they just can't leave. And for me, that says it all.
She really gave us a template for what a modern food person's career is: the TV, the cookbooks, everything.
For me, and I knew this working with Julia, and I relearned it reading As Always Julia, which is the letters between Julia Child and Avis Devoto. Julia, for all you saw, the, you know, funny, kind of awkward television personality, was one of the hardest workers I've ever met. Julia wanted everything to be perfect, and she would use every ounce of her energy to make sure that it was like that. Whatever looked easy on television had taken hours of work behind it. And so when I wrote Baking with Julia, Julia went on tour, and we'd always talked every morning. We would telephone and one another. And when she was on tour, she called me twice a day. She'd call me in the morning to say hello, and then she'd call me at the end of the day to say how the day had gone. And what she would always say is, the recipes worked perfectly. For her, that was so important.
Yeah, that was the litmus test, for
right?
sure. Yeah, yeah. I would just add, she was not by any means the first person to cook on TV, but she was the first celebrity chef. Mm-hmm. And I think she had a huge impact on the conversation about food. And she got chefs to do new things. She got the public to try new things. And she accelerated the conversation that was already happening.
Absolutely.
She was a catalyst for that. And people ask me, well, what would she make of today's 24/7 culinary circus? And my response is, well, on the one hand, she'd be very disappointed because it's all about glitz and glam and faux competitions and soap opera melodramas.
So not Julia.
No. She considered food a civilized art, and she liked the camaraderie and the creativity. On the other hand, this 24/7 media saturation has brought a huge audience to food, which was what she was really about. And I think she would be thrilled by that. So I think she'd have very mixed feelings. And she would always say, you know, you've got to eat with gusto. If you don't eat with gusto, the gastric juices won't work. And I think that kind of gusto is what people makes her so appealing even now.
You know, that's a word we don't use often enough.
Gusto.
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 Let's bring
exclamation
it back.
Exclamation point.
Let's bring it back.
Absolutely. All right. We are now going to do the speediest of speed rounds because we're about to get kicked out of the studio. So coffee or tea, Alex?
For me or for Julia?
For you.
Oh, for me. Coffee. Tea for Julia.
Coffee for me.
Sweet or salty?
Salty.
Both.
That's what's no it? Fair. Hey, I would say both.
No, too late. I got it.
What's in your fridge right now?
I haven't been home for a while, so I don't know. I'm on the road.
And I've just started being on the road today. So
so whatever it is, it'll be moldy by the time
I hope
you
it's
get
some
home.
Gold beer.
What kitchen tool do you use the most?
Knife.
Hands.
Good one. If you were trapped on a desert island with one food celebrity who's not Julia Child, who would it be? Who comes to mind first?
Mario.
Oh, I just went blank. Come back to me.
I would say, actually, let me revise that. I would say Lydia. I just ran into Lydia in Toronto the other day, and we had the most fabulous conversation. She's so lovely, and she gave me a huge hug, and we're going to get together, and she's the best. So if you can't have Julia, how about Lydia?
Dory, we're
I'm
not,
still not
we're
there.
We're not going to let you
let's,
off the,
okay, okay.
We're going to have
along,
to answer this via social media. Where would you like to travel to next?
Oof. Bhutan.
Oh, it's supposed to be so beautiful. Yeah, I would like to go to Scandinavia. I'd like to go to Greece. I'd like, I want to go back to Japan. Anything else? I mean, I would just go. I'd love to travel.
After college, I traveled. I was meant to go to India, Nepal, and Japan for 3 months, but it ended up taking me 2 years, and I went around the world. I'm a bit of a travel addict. I love it, and it's how I became a writer because I was keeping diaries on this and that journey around the world. And so that's a dangerous question to ask
But
me.
Bhutan's a great answer. And Dory, we are going to follow up with you via social media about who you will be stuck with on a desert island. Sadly, that's it for today's show. Maybe, I'd love to have you both back.
Merci and bon appetit.
Open invitation, absolutely.
This was so lovely. Thank you.
It was
you.
A pleasure speaking with both of you today. Everyone needs to run out and buy these two books, and all your books are wonderful. So thank you for everything you've contributed. Thanks, as always, to our engineer, Dave Tadashore, and much love to Knopf for supporting this season of Radio Cherry Bomb and for publishing such beautiful books. Don't forget to support Heritage Radio, the not-for-profit home of Radio Cherry Bomb. To make a donation, visit heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.
Hi, I'm Katie Mosman-Wadler, and I'm the Deputy Director of Heritage Radio Network. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? My very own sister, Freya Balmer. She's the Director of Product Management for Food.com at Scripps Networks, and she's also a boss in the kitchen and a great mom to my two awesome nephews. Love you, sis.